You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of April 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show, as a five-year review of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty looms, Iran calls for a binding timetable for global nuclear disarmament by everyone else. But will this ever happen? What is the future of nuclear weapons? Samira Shackle and Raffaello Pantucci will join me to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including new weapons sales by the US to Egypt and Pakistan, which has hardly ever worked out badly before. Canada drops its first bombs on Islamic State targets inside Syria. Will other coalition partners now join them? The family feud currently consuming France's National Front and amusing everybody else. And the UK's rejection of another offer to listen to Greece asking for the Elgin Marbles back. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the defence think tank RUSI, and author of the new book, We Love Death As You Love Life, Britain's Suburban Terrorists, which you should obviously buy if you already haven't, and Samira Shackle, London-based freelance journalist, regular Monocle 24 contributor, assistant editor at The New Humanist. Welcome both. Now, the latest hand in the high-stakes nuclear poker match involving Iran and the rest of the world may have concluded with what looked like a minor win for everyone. But the game goes on, and Tehran has upped the ante. Iran's deputy UN ambassador, Gholam Hossein Degani, called for a comprehensive, binding, irreversible, and verifiable treaty eliminating everybody's nuclear weapons. Samira, first of all, where, so far as it's ever possible to tell with Iranian diplomats, is he going with this?
I'm not entirely sure, as you say. I mean, I don't think with any diplomacy you can ever be entirely sure, but I think that certainly one of the aims will be to point out the hypocrisy of world powers sort of bargaining very hard so that Iran doesn't have the capacity to make a nuclear bomb without taking any steps towards reducing their own nuclear arsenals. And so I think that's that sort of question of hypocrisy has been a really important line of Iranian argument over the last few years, that how can you tell us we don't have the right to nuclear power when everyone else has it, and so on. So I think that's probably one of the aims, given that the five-year review of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is coming up in the next few weeks.
Well, the traditional answer, and I don't think it's without merit, offered when Iran says, well, you've all got nuclear weapons, why shouldn't we have nuclear weapons? The traditional answer has been because none of us have ever explicitly threatened the extermination of a fellow member of the United Nations. Is this, against possibly that context, Raffaello, Iran attempting to scramble towards the moral high ground?
I think partially. I think it's also probably an element of playing to the political game at home. There's an element of, with this deal that seemed to be approached, I know that some of the reporting that seemed to be going out in the Iranian media in particular, dealing to the more hawkish elements there, was to try to show them that they hadn't given in and capitulated to the West and that they were still holding a hard hand. So by pushing it off in this direction, they're kind of changing the dynamic of the conversation a bit and probably showing the audience at home that, you know, this isn't the great Iranian government giving way to the sort of Western powers. This is, in fact, them, you know, holding them all to account and trying to bring a sort of new world order that's being directed by Iran.
The other possibility that occurred to me, Samira, is this because there is this weird, it's not just that double standard, there's another weird double standard going on with nuclear weapons, which is there are the five acknowledged nuclear powers who we apparently have to live with. There's Pakistan and India, which have tested nuclear weapons, North Korea, which has tested nuclear weapons, and the one which occurred to me that Iran might be trying to flush out into some formal acknowledgement is, of course, Israel, which has nuclear weapons, as absolutely everybody knows, but weirdly still refuses to admit that. Is that another sort of dog whistle in the back of what Mr. Degani is saying here?
Yeah, I'm sure it is. And I think that that sort of point about the moral high ground and playing to the crowd at home is sort of part of the same picture of that. I think that it's quite a source of outrage to the public in Iran, to the government in Iran, that Israel's nuclear weapon is sort of allowed without any international or without much international comment. I think that it's also important to remember that the regimes always maintain that they're not seeking, in the course of these negotiations, that they're not seeking nuclear weapons, that they're just simply seeking nuclear energy. And so, I mean, whether or not you believe in the veracity of that is a wholly separate question. But I think given that that's the official line, this sort of advocating for peace and getting rid of all the nuclear weapons and disarmament sort of fits into that picture, since they're saying that they've got entirely peaceful aims with the nuclear program.
I think the flushing out question is an interesting one. And I actually think, I wonder if it's more directed towards Saudi Arabia. Because at the end of the day, what we're really seeing here at the moment, and this sort of plays into the bigger regional picture, this struggle between Iran and the sort of the Sunni countries and the sort of rise of Iran, there is a great sense of concern that exists that one of the consequences of the sort of Iranian nuclear deal is not necessarily Israel-related, though clearly that's going to increase tensions there. It's that the Saudis might decide that they need to get a bomb to defend themselves, you know, as the sort of the big center of the Sunni world, now that the center of the Shia world does, they need it to sort of counter that. And that sort of problem of onward proliferation is something that's really, it's a real concern. And there's been lots of questions raised about whether it's possible that the Saudis and the Pakistanis have long signed a deal, and in fact this might lead to Pakistan handing over some sort of weapon accelerating their program. I wonder if it's more thinking in that kind of space, and they're saying, okay, well, we need to draw this threshold now, get everyone off nuclear weapons, before you start to get this whole question of sort of onward proliferation, other powers deciding, well, if the Iranians have it, well, we need it as well.
I mean, that is obviously the nightmare that everybody, or at least everybody sane, is attempting to avoid, which is a full-scale nuclear arms race in the Middle East, because it's very, very difficult to imagine that ending well. What Ambassador Degani has floated here, though, is it's a utopian grand diplomatic bargain idea which has existed since about August the 7th, 1945, of a world free of nuclear weapons. And it does come up occasionally. Ronald Reagan sort of vaguely waved it in the direction of Mikhail Gorbachev, though it is uncertain in what kind of contact Reagan was with planet Earth at that point. Samira, is it at this point so utopian that it's even worth discussing? Is it actually imaginable that we could reach a point one day at which all the world's nuclear armed superpowers just go, yeah, fine, we all trust each other enough?
I think it's really important to keep talking about it, however unlikely it seems at the present moment. Because I think the sort of negativity of saying it's not worth pushing for this idea because it's so unrealistic is a surefire way to ensure it never happens. But I do certainly think that it seems very unlikely at the present moment. There was a North Korean representative, I think, said that their nuclear weapons were the life and soul of the nation.
I had highlighted that quote right there, which does seem to end the conversation, doesn't
exactly.
it? Because if we're going to cast one nation in a real-life version of the mouse that roared, I'm pretty sure I don't want it to be North Korea.
And I think the other thing is just the whole nuclear weapons question is so dominated by local regional rivalries. You've got sort of India and Pakistan are not going to want to give up their weapons because of each other. You've got
no one's going to go first there, are
exactly.
they?
Exactly. So I think it's that sort of, those sorts of small scale rivalries dominate it to such an extent that I don't think we could certainly not in the present moment envision a time when those distrusts don't exist.
Well, the UK election row of the day today, Raffaello, is this story that the Conservatives are trying to float, suggesting that Labour would be willing to ditch Britain's nuclear deterrent, the Trident submarines, in order to do a deal with the Scottish Nationalist parties, who don't like Trident, especially because it's based in Scotland, which they want to be an independent non-nuclear nation. Leaving aside the fact that this is a patently mad story, because there's absolutely no imaginable way Labour would ever enter into a bargain with the SNP on those terms.
We hope.
I mean, really, it is...
It would be very surprising.
A couple of shadow ministers have already said they would resign before they would countenance any such thing, which... But anyway, it is today's mad election story. Leaving aside the mad election story, does Britain's still need to be a nuclear armed nation? Is the idea of just giving up Trident something Britain should seriously consider? Because it does need to be upgraded, and that is not going to come cheap.
It is not going to come cheap, but then in some ways it goes to some of the questions we're talking about before. You know, we can the North Korean deputy UN ambassador statement that our nuclear force is the life and soul of the nation is a sort of an amusing remark within a sort of North Korean context, but the reality is, if you're a nuclear power, you know, it does put you in a certain community on the world stage, and it does mean that you have a certain power that others don't have. This is why a country like Iran is running so desperately towards it, because it wants to prove that it's in that first rank of powers. So, you know, for the UK
to kind of imagine Ukraine's regretting giving them up at this point.
Well, yes, and Kazakhstan as well, and some of those other FSU countries, you think, you know, it would have changed the dynamic of where they were sort of in today's world. So for the UK to be instead going in the other direction, which is instead scaling it back to such a sort of basic capacity that there's a question of if it's really sort of useful and a point for, you know, a useful, productive thing anymore. But at the same time, it does mean that the UK is still a nuclear power and can punch at that sort of level. And if you look at the general sort of withdrawal that we've seen in terms of British foreign policy, in terms of the places that the UK is able and is actually projecting power around the world, they're increasingly going down. You know, we're down to one aircraft carrier, which I think isn't being used at the moment, while waiting for a new one to come online. You know, all these sorts of signals of being a global power are slowly being sort of peeled away. And the fact that you can have this as a major part of the sort of conversation here in the UK, further sort of reducing the United Kingdom's sort of global presence, is, I think, sort of a depressing statement of the sort of recession of the UK as a global power.
Is that just final thought on this, Raffaello? Because I just wonder if there's any point in a country like the UK having a nuclear weapon, if everyone's pretty sure that they are that sort of recessed power that would never use it. I mean, even as long ago as 1982, you had the outwardly preposterous scenario of a third world banana republic seizing the sovereign territory of a nuclear armed first world nation. But Argentina would have done that knowing there was no imaginable way that the British would even vaguely threaten the use of nuclear weapons, because that's a judgment you can make about Britain. I'd be less confident maybe where Iran's concerned, but that is a judgment people would make about Britain, that they wouldn't do it.
Well, I mean, I think that the point is that we can look at the situation now and say that they'd never do it, but times change and countries evolve. And if we look at the world and we look how it's changing, there was a sense, you know, that we were moving towards a non-polar world, you know, sort of Francis Fukuyama's end of history concept. And, you know, this is the end of time and nothing will change from now on. Well, no, things do change. And it turns out that states do still have wars, and it turns out the states collapse and all these things happen. And so I think, you know, one has to be prepared for that eventuality. And if a country is given something like this up, well, it's hard to sort of get back. And so the question becomes, what do you do if you're suddenly presented with a situation that would have been important?
That line must have sold Fukuyama a lot of books, but I'm kind of thinking he kind of wishes he'd never said it at this point. We will continue on the cheerful subject of weapons proliferation. The United States has announced that it may sell $57 million worth of air-to-surface missiles to Egypt. And this comes days after it floated a $1 billion sale to Pakistan of attack helicopters and associated hardware. Samira, recently back from Pakistan, the question that obviously needs to be asked here is, what could possibly go wrong?
I think, well, obviously plenty, but I think that that's always the question with arms deals, isn't it? It's quite an unsavoury business that I think that lots of governments would probably prefer is kept away from the public, because it does sort of jar. I think particularly the case of Egypt is quite a good example that we've had over the last couple of years nearly now, sort of repeated condemnations from the US government about the sort of new military-backed regime's brutality against its own people, and yet it's simultaneously preparing this potential big arms sale. And I think that it's in the forum of things like weapons deals that you really see those kind of double standards or realpolitik or whatever you want to call it that's necessary in foreign policy. So you might have a government that in the US or the UK, for instance, that's very critical of certain elements of the Pakistani or the Egyptian authorities, and yet on the other hand, firstly has a huge financial incentive of these weapon sales, which bring in huge amounts of money, obviously, and also in the case of both of these countries, want their cooperation on counter-terror policy. And so I think that really sort of dominates lots of the concrete action that's taken. So you might have sort of lip service paid to human rights abuses, whatever it is, on home turf, and yet when those same people committing those same human rights abuses are your partners in this sort of perceived global struggle against terrorism, then that's what takes the precedent.
Which returns us, I guess, a bit to you know, that age-old, well-worn line of Roosevelt's on Somoza's, that he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. It just occurred to me, staying with that, Samira, that is there a sense, a yearning, if you will, from America to a restoration of what now seems like a long ago, that actually, indeed, that end of history status quo, the sort of the pre-Arab Spring stability, such as it was in North Africa, and the pre-9/11 2011 stability such as it was in Pakistan? Are they trying to put the toothpaste back in the tube?
Yeah, I'm sure they are. I'm sure they would sort of prefer a more stable time, although those times, I'm sure, had their own instabilities then. But I think certainly Egypt, there's a sense of history repeating itself, that for years and years and years, America cooperated with a series of relatively secular strongmen in the Middle East, sort of despite the proclaimed support of democracy. When those new democracies turned out, Islamist leaders didn't like it that much and are now back to, in Egypt anyway, to the slightly more comfortable position of supporting a military-backed strongman again who's relatively secular. So I think there's very clear secularity there.
Raffaello, is there any evidence to suggest that a willingness to sell arms to people you may not like terribly much does actually buy you any influence with them? And I guess, and or to think of the same question a different way, would there be any imaginable upside as far as America's concerned to not selling this kit to Egypt and Pakistan?
I think that you're probably dealing with two slightly different situations. The perspective that with Egypt, I think, depressingly, there is incredible circularity, as Samir was saying, about what's happened there. The fact that you went from the sort of Mubarak regime, when the US government, I think it used to give like a billion in arms deals with the Egyptian government and the Egyptian military. And this bought them a very strong relationship with the Egyptian military that meant that you did have some stability in that country. And Egypt is really a very key country if you're looking at the Middle East and North Africa. And so the fact that you now have a new strongman in power there, and the Egyptian government does have some semblance over control of most of the country. I mean, the Sinai is pretty wild these days, but, you know, of other parts of it, they are able to sort of exert some authority. It does mean that they will protect and make sure that that part is secure. And that's important if you think about how terrorism has emanated from Egypt in the past. The problem for me, and I think, you know, is that it's not really a long-term solution. And the fact that you have gone back to a strongman government in Egypt, I don't think is really going to resolve anything in the long term. It's probably just prolonging the process by which you'll eventually have to get to set up some sort of a democratic system, which means that you'll get some sort of a system where you don't have people who feel so excluded from it that they want to kill it. And this just sort of continues that space. But at the same time, you have to deal the hand you're dealt. And I suspect this is kind of the way that America thinks about it. I must say, the other thing that was interesting about this particular story is to look at the Pakistan side of it. Because the helicopters, I mean, they've always done deals with the Pakistanis on sort of CT and other equipment from the United States. And they've always had a very tense relationship between the two. And often it's actually Congress that blocks these deals from going through rather than the administration. The administration is usually quite keen to get them through, but they're not. But actually last week, the other interesting deal that was signed on a sort of military basis was the Pakistanis said they were going to buy $5 billion worth of submarines from the Chinese, which I think speaks a lot to that sort of relationship there. And I think if you're going to look at these, you know, a lot would be made out of this and the fact the Americans are now trying to buy some sort of support from the Pakistanis. The reality is, it's the Chinese military relationship with the Pakistanis that I'd be much more interested in than the US one.
Okay, well, one country which definitely is making use of American-supplied air-to-surface technology is Canada, whose Air Force has carried out its first strikes on Islamic State targets inside Syria. Canada is now the only country other than the US hitting Islamic State outside Iraq. Samira, how great is the danger? And it is one that's been floated before when America started bombing inside Syria. How great is the danger of the Western world turning into Bashar al-Assad's air force?
Yeah, it is a danger, I think. I mean, not quite, perhaps, given that it's quite a close target. But I think that question is very interesting and continues to be very interesting. This idea that you have the US still officially their line is that Assad must go, and yet actually there's some level of cooperation happening. They're sort of striking the same targets, but I think that the US airstrikes and now Canadian airstrikes in Syria are obviously part of a broader program of airstrikes and a broader strategy, which is also happening a lot in Iraq. And I think the idea is sort of shore up Iraq first and all at the same time ensure that there aren't safe havens in Syria. But it's not, I think it's deliberately staying tightly focused on sort of small areas of ISIS control in Syria for that very reason, that they don't want to be Assad's extension of his air force.
The Canadian Air Force are claiming that in their first action they have blown up what they described as an Islamic State garrison on the outskirts of Raqqa, which could mean literally anything. Raffaello, are two F-18s with maple leaves painted on the tails going to make any difference one way or the other?
I mean, it just shows there's an international coalition. You know, the UK at the moment, I think, has one airstrike a day going on in support of this sort of operations, the counter-ISIS operation.
When they can find anything to hit.
Well, exactly. When they can find anything to hit that's anything substantial. I mean, you're 100% right that there are no big targets. It tends to be a sort of pounding sand type situation. But, you know, it is a demonstration that there is a global alliance that's against ISIS. The problem for me is that actually that narrative feeds into ISIS narrative. And ISIS says that they're confronting the world. And the more powers there are on the other side fighting against them, the more that comes to reality.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. Raffaello and Samira will still be with me when we return. Up next, the Le Pen family feud and a big week for Greece in historical score settling.
On Saturday, the 18th of April, tune in to Monocle 24 to hear full live coverage of Monocle's inaugural Quality of Life Conference, which is taking place in Lisbon, Portugal.
With the help of 20 speakers, we're going to reveal the best projects, people, and practices helping to create dynamic cities around the globe.
Our special guests include legendary typographer Eric Spiekerman, renowned London-based designer Ilse Crawford, and the V&A's director Martin Roth.
The day's sessions will explore how media brands make our cities.
You'll discover how to build the perfect house.
You'll hear how to reinvent the high street and explore the role of culture in our urban spaces.
All that plus music from Luisa Sobral too.
And you can hear it all right here on Monocle 24.
Tune in for full coverage of the first Monocle Quality of Life Conference live from Lisbon on the 18th of April. Our special coverage begins at 9 a.m. London time.
Find out more at conference.monocle.com.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his report across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are the freelance journalist and Deputy Assistant Editor of the New Humanist, Samira Shackle, and Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI, also author of We Love Death As You Love Life. Now, it is far from unusual for populist slash extremist parties to try to make themselves more palatable by repudiating once held positions or even former office holders. It is less common that the leader whitewashing the past is attempting to plaster over their own father. Mm. Such, however, is the brouhaha currently consuming France's National Front, whose leader, Marine Le Pen, has just become the last person in the world to have noticed that her father, Jean-Marie, is an awful xenophobic crank. Samira, first of all, is there really any way to react to this beyond, you know, enjoying a good chuckle?
There we go.
That's subject dispensed with. Moving along.
But I think that soap opera element is certainly very appealing, that there's a all these sort of weird details all the time about the Le Pen's family living arrangements. You've got Marine Le Pen living on the edge of the father's estate and the ex-wife living somewhere there. And all of those things, I think, are quite enjoyable soap opera. But we certainly shouldn't lose sight of the fact amid that soap opera that it's a pretty sinister and nasty movement. And I think that what a lot of critics would say is that Marine Le Pen is, since she took over the running of the party a few years ago, she has been sort of embarked on this programme of detoxifying the brand, as it were, and sort of moving away from her father's quite open anti-Semitism and racism and so on. And yet, I think critics would certainly say that most of the views of the party are the same. And I think that's certainly true, that we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that, trying not to say embarrassing things in public doesn't mean that there aren't still sort of quite bad for society views being propagated by this party.
I mean, I think we can probably take as read that there is a certain theatrical aspect to Marine's protestations of horror at her old man's latest outburst, in which he was again somewhat dismissive of the Holocaust, weirdly pro Marshal Pétain, the traitorous strongman of Vichy France. My question is, and I'm not really inclined towards trying to furnish the National Front with tactical advice, but I'm wondering whether this actually works for her, because there's a conventional wisdom around the National Front and around similar parties throughout Europe, whether it's Jobbik in Hungary or UKIP here in the UK, that, you know, if only people knew what their real views were, they wouldn't vote for them. My rather bleak suspicion is that their real views are exactly why people do.
I think that's probably part of it. And in a way, you know, the cynic in me says that could this be a way of Marine Le Pen sort of exposing that far right of the party, denouncing them publicly, you know, and it's her own father. So what can be more credible than that? And that helps sort of do further what you're talking about, this detoxifying of the brand of the Front National, and therefore make it a more credible party, when in reality, this probably very much does resonate with their base. I think there was just elections in France at a sort of a county level, I think it was. And I think the Front National didn't do as well as they were expecting. I think they did sort of well in certain places, but I don't think overall they did that, the sort of sweeping great show they're hoping. And so in some ways, having this sort of confrontation now further helps distance a bit from that side of it and maybe helps make them a little more publicly palatable. The other thing that this story reminded me of a bit, and I was thinking of this because, of course, of Lee Kuan Yew's death a few weeks ago, was that there was a moment when Lee Kuan Yew started to go a bit off the deep end in some of the comments that he was making public. And it was when he got older in life, and it was very funny because there was a very sort of public moment where I think the political party around, the PAP, actually said to him, you know, maybe we should take you back from the front line a bit. And so lo and behold, he stopped appearing in public and he stopped talking and he sort of just pulled himself back and disappeared. And it sort of helped restore his kind of image, you know, in a way, because he did seem to be becoming this very cranky old man talking about Muslims in weird ways and doing these other sorts of things. And so I wonder if we're looking at either a sort of natural thing in that way of an old man just becoming an old cranky man, or a very tactical move to try to further expose these ideas and help sort of make the Front National appear under Marine Le Pen a new party that can be sort of dealt with.
A bit from column A and a bit from column B, I suspect. We should look finally tonight at Greece before the clock beats us. Greece has been having a lively old time of it. Not content with invoicing Germany for €300 billion for World War II, Greece has also harumphed afresh at the latest refusal by the UK to engage in mediation over the Elgin Marbles, which are, as if you didn't already know, sculptures from the Parthenon long ensconced in the British Museum. Samira, it's like the Spaniards and Gibraltar. Do you really think anybody actually outside official circles in Greece really cares about this?
Well, I mean, I'm sure the people on the UN's culture and mediation body do.
Well, it's their job to care about this. But I mean, but Greece has been making such a thing of this for so long.
Yeah, that's true. They have. I think that, I mean, and I think that certainly from our side, the British Museum seem to care quite a lot about it as well. I don't think there's very much willingness here to give the sculptures back. I thought it was quite interesting that the ministers from the UK dismissed it so out of hand and just said that they weren't willing to enter into any mediation because it was obviously just an attempt to get the sculptures back, which I think states their position quite unequivocally.
I mean, Raffaello, what do you think? Why, I mean, does every museum with Greek stuff in it have to send it back? Should every museum with stuff in it from anywhere else in the world send it back to where it came from?
Well, I mean, this sets a dangerous precedent if they do, right? I mean, the Louvre is full of stuff that Napoleon stole from across Europe. So is that going to suddenly strip itself out and send those back to Italy and the other parts of the world that he took them from? I mean, it's a very odd sort of precedent to go down. I can understand in some context where it's been done, but, you know, you would see it happening in a situation where you're going back to a place that might be able to do something with them. But I suppose Greece at the moment seems a somewhat chaotic place, and should they really be allocating money towards these things and not worry about these large holes in the budget that they keep discovering?
You would think, wouldn't you? We will have to leave it there. Raffaello Pantucci and Samira Shackle, thank you both as ever for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sara Moneta, and our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. For the next half hour, Tom Edwards will keep you company with Monocle's international playlist. Andrew Tuck follows at 1900 hours with The Urbanist. At 2200, it's The Monocle Daily with, I think I'm right in saying, Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'll also be your host for that. But for this edition, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.